Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning were first elected to Seanad Éireann in 1987. Both are independents by name and by temperament, but they worked closely together in the Senate chamber. Both were born in the 1940s, grew up in the 50s, came of age in the 60s. But their lives tell two different stories of what it means to be Irish. Former Senator Joe O'Toole is from Dingle in County Kerry. A primary school teacher, he was leader of the INTO and the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. Senator David Norris is a Joycean scholar. He has worked for gay rights, taking a landmark case to Europe to end discrimination against gay people in Ireland. He has just published his autobiography, David Norris, A Kick Against the Pricks, which I understand is a biblical phrase, David. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start off in your childhoods. First of all, Joe, you grew up in Dingle.
Dingle is still the most beautiful place on earth. I mean, I fall in love with it every time I go back to it, you know. And it's one of those places, I don't think I could ever live there forever, but I've never left it in my head, you know. And it has shaped my life. To be quite honest with you, and I picked up a lot of knowledge since I left Dingle. But since I left Dingle in 1965, I've learned nothing new about people. I've learned a lot of new things. I've got some qualifications and degrees and things. But I've learned nothing new that I didn't learn behind shops of my mother or my uncles or my grandfather or my grandmother's in Dingle.
You were surrounded. And used that wisdom wonderfully in the Senate. And I can tell you this, if you have Joe as a friend, if you have him as a representative, if Joe O'Toole is in your corner, that knowledge of humanity, of people that he learnt in Dingle, stands him in good stead. And if he's in your corner, you're doing pretty well.
I've never actually been accused of having humanity before, but it's really nice to hear it. I hope my mother is listening.
Well, you're certainly, I hope she is too, and she'll then scold me, because any time Joe and I were on radio or television together, she used to say that awful man who keeps interrupting you.
Of course, to be quite honest with you, that was never true. But I always, to soften David out, like going into a television studio, I'd say, you know, David, like I was talking to my mother during the week and she said, that last time you were on the programme with David Norris, he'd never let you speak. Poor old David is so soft and so carey. It always kind of kept him quiet for 5 minutes in the early part of the programme.
This is the cuteness from Dingle coming out. This
Absolutely.
Is what he learned.
But look, you were surrounded by strong women in Dingle and you learned a lot in your mother's
Absolutely,
shop as well.
Yeah. I mean, one of the great surprises of me when I came to Dublin was that there was a great demand for equality for women. It was a sort of, like, if anybody knew my mother was a businesswoman and ran a business at the time. My grandmother in Dingle ran a business and farms and the business of her kids. My grandmother in Lettermore, she was widowed at a very young age and she ran the business. So I never saw weak women around me, and I have four sisters, I guarantee you. Like, it's always a struggle, like, to get a word in our house. So I grew up with that. And also, like, a kind of a sense of sort of respect towards women. Like, women, we saw the bad side as well. And I'm not, you know, I don't want to kind of over-egg the thing. But I wasn't completely sure about this issue that there was a need for equality for women until I saw where the rest of the world lives, and it was something I supported all along. Similarly, by the way, I didn't know, like, why, if people were gay, why that was a big issue for the world, you know. I think Dingle is quite iconoclastic, you know, in that sense, you know, and it doesn't conform to norms. And
quite bohemian in its own.
Well, the whole of Kerry, I think.
Yeah. Well, I suppose
there is something rebellious, and you hear it in the way they treat language. That's why I love Kerry, because people in Kerry are insurrectionary about language and they use words whatever way they want to.
Tell me about your background, though. You were born in the Belgian Congo. How did that happen?
Well, my father was quite a war hero in the First World War. He got the Marine VC, the Lloyd's Medal, which they properly call the Marine VC.
He was English, wasn't he?
He was English. Yeah. And you got quite a lot of money for rescuing ships. He got 900 quid for bringing in HMS Scepter. That would buy you 2 houses in London. After the war, he was an inventor and engineer, and he put it into a little business making lifts for the grand hotels. Went bust in 1929. His sister Daisy, who was a remarkable woman, had married an Irish man with land in Clare and some houses in Dublin and so on. He came over for a tennis party, met my mother, swept her off her feet, straight from the bogs of Leash to Central Africa, stopping only at 8 o'clock in the morning in St. Anne's Church in Dawson Street to get married. And she fell in love with the Congo. And she loved the people. She really loved the people. And she loved the white nuns as well. She loved the indigenous people. She also loved the Belgian nuns. They used to go to mass all the time. And she was very good with animals, and she used to tame animals from the bush when they're out in the bush, and she brought them back to Julian Huxley, who was a friend of hers in the London Zoo. She brought the first Bosman's Potter in captivity, a lovely little teddy bear-like creature.
Was she Catholic, David, that she went to Mass?
Well, she would have said she was Catholic, but she meant Anglican because she maintained we were the real Catholic Church.
Not much of a difference, actually.
There's no difference, actually.
My greatest pal when I was small was Michael Moore. And we had a fight when we were about seven over a Foden lorry, which is a dinky toy in the sandpit. And Michael won by saying, yeah, you're not even a Catholic. And I went home in floods of tears to my mother. And she said, what's wrong? And I said, Michael Moore says I'm not a Catholic. She said, of course you are, darling. Don't you say it every Sunday in the cathedral. I believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church. You're just not part of the Roman era like Michael Moran. I didn't know what the Roman era was, but unlike George Bush, I could recognise the weapon of mass destruction when I saw it, and I went straight back and flattened Michael with the Roman era.
But of course, you're not one. That was the error. Like you went off in your own way.
The Roman
Catholic Church is one holy Catholic and apostolic.
Okay, we're getting back to his childhood now. Yes. You, there was yourself and your brother, is that right? And is it true your mom brought you home, actually, when you were quite young?
Yes, I was 6 months. And we came back on the Copacabana. And wonderful Gerard Siggins, for the book that I wrote, found a photograph of the Copacabana. And I showed it to my brother. And he pointed out the two little shrouded areas, and he said those were the anti-aircraft guns, and we'd been expecting to be attacked by submarines because the Atlantic was full of U-boats, but instead we were attacked from the air, and my brother hid and watched the attacks, and he remembers to this day hearing the shell casings fall on the deck. And then we got to Portsmouth or somewhere, and my uncle, who was high up in the British establishment, had a car, and we went through the rubble of the Blitz and got up to Holyhead and then to Dunleary.
So it's hard to recall that now or even to imagine it, but it was quite risky coming back during the Second World War, wasn't it, for your mum to bring back two little boys to Ireland?
It was, but she was a very courageous woman in her own way. And I love that sense of adventure, you know, to go from Laois, from rural Ireland, where her father was a not terribly successful farmer, and straight off to Africa without a thought.
Extraordinary.
It was wonderful.
But the only sad thing for you is that your mum brought you back for good reasons, but it meant that you didn't see your dad as much as you might have, and then he died when you were very young, David.
I was 5 and a half, and I'd only seen him 3 times. And I have those memories of him. I can remember Ballybunion, not too far from West Kerry.
What can you remember about that?
I remember it exactly. I went down with Yvonne Scannell to speak at a conference down there some 10 years ago or so. And she said, have you ever been to Ballybunion before? I said, yes. And she said, what do you remember? And I said, I remember the guest houses with these kind of lovely pastel colours and the glass porches they had. And I remember the Strand. And I remember a cliff with a hole in it where the waves went through. And there was the remains of a castle on the top. She said, that's absolutely right. When we were there, I said, 1948. And you see, people think you have a remarkable memory, but you'll find with children, one or both of whose parents die when they're young, they revisit the memories. A person whose parents haven't died, they spring clean them, they get rid of them. So I don't think there's anything phenomenal about my memory.
Do you remember much about your father?
I remember him taking me on in a little kind of carrier on the back of a bicycle up along the Dodder, and we followed the course of the Dodder. I remember that. I remember him playing cricket with my brother in the garden, and I remember being made to have a siesta with him in the afternoon, and I absolutely hated it because I could hear the other kids out playing.
Oh, yeah.
And I was fidgeting, and it was the only time my father was cross with me. But I also remember him taking me with him to see his mother, who had come over to live in Ireland. And she was a very imperious, aristocratic old lady. And I ran across the room because I heard a steam train. I wanted to see it. And she reprimanded me very harshly.
For running indoors.
Yes, for running. You know, well brought up children didn't run, certainly in the presence of their grandmother.
What happened to your father that he died when you were so young? And do you remember when he did it, that moment?
He died of a massive coronary attack, thrombosis. And a telegram arrived and said that he'd been taken ill. And then another one said he was getting worse. It went on for a couple of days, and eventually they dropped the bomb that he had died. In fact, he died immediately, but this was their idea of breaking it gently, which actually was rather cruel. They didn't intend it to be. And I remember my mother gathering my brother and myself together, and she said, "There's only the three of us now with our arms around us. Mm. We'll have to stick together."
It's
and they
were very movingly told in the book.
They were crying. And I nearly gave myself a hernia trying to squeeze out a tear, because it didn't mean anything to me. Yeah. I missed the car terribly. But I didn't miss my father because I didn't know him. Yeah. But again, I found a photograph for the book, and it is really haunting to me because I remember my mother taking me out to what was then Collinstown Aerodrome. And it was that beautiful Art Deco banana-shaped building by, I think, Michael Scott, but it's one of the great pieces of Irish architecture. And we were up on the top, the viewing platform, and I remember waving to my father, and my father, at the last moment, at the very foot of the steps, turned, and with his attaché case one hand, he waved. And I didn't realise until I went trawling through thousands of photographs, my mother had taken a photograph of that exact moment. And that was the first time that I felt a real sense of loss. And I almost cried when I saw it.
So have you ever cried for your father?
No. Well, except for the one tear that practically strangulated my hernia.
Do you think your life would have been different if your father had lived?
Oh, well, of course, undoubtedly. But I mean, it's like the thing about if a butterfly flapped its wings, you know, the tsunami wouldn't have happened.
I think it's more than that, David. I mean, I do think, like, looking at it, that it would have made a huge difference. Because I've always felt about David, and I've said this to him, that, like, he would be most engaging as a family person. I kind of always felt that he would be comfortable in a family. You know,
very much so.
And, and I do think that there's a sense of loss there. I would think, anyway. And I think that it has led to, somewhere along the way, to I'm not overstating this now, but a kind of a certain sense of, maybe, I'm not sure, somewhere between loneliness and isolation for David. But I just see him with people, with children and with others, that I've always felt him to be very comfortable. And you know, I just kind of felt that there is you know, something there that would have developed.
Well, I'm not aware of it, you see.
But is it because you don't let yourself be aware of it?
Possibly, yes. But put it this way, I don't think, I mean, the Freudian psychiatrist would probably say that's why I was gay. I don't believe that for a minute.
No.
But I do think that it means that I am attracted to the strength of a man. You know, the idea
like Joe.
Of, yes, absolutely. It's in all my friendships, in all the people that I really have affection for, and care about, there is a strength, there is a feeling that at the end of the day they will be able to protect you in some way. So maybe that's a throwback.
I'm not sure, David. I mean, just think back for a second. I mean, you really kind of clung to your aunt as well.
I did.
Protected her all those years.
Yes.
I mean, something would come up and David said, "Well, sorry, I have to go see my aunt,"
yes,
or whatever.
In a different way.
Yeah, but it's nonetheless, like, it's the point I'm making, like, that sense of family is something that David is not known for, perhaps. And I think in his book, the first part of the book, where he roots himself very firmly in his family, is something that people will find unusual or
unexpected.
Well, I really love my aunt, and she was a most remarkable woman because she was a brilliant mathematician, and she discovered that they'd opened up one of the Oxford or Cambridge colleges to women, and particularly to do, she wanted to go and do maths, and my grandfather wouldn't let her because he thought it wasn't ladylike. And she was stuck. She was the oldest, and she was stuck there.
Your mother's
looking
or your father's sister?
My mother's sister. And I remember her saying to me, it's a wonderful
what was her
phrase,
name?
Elizabeth Constance Fitzpatrick, and she hated all of those names except Fitzpatrick. And I called her Connie, but I don't call her that in the book because she was terribly private. But she was kept at home in Leash, and she told me that because all the young men had been killed in the war, but she said that she used to sit in the back kitchen with seed catalogues from London, planning her herbaceous borders. Oh. And she said, like a pelican in the wilderness. Which I think is such a wonderful, haunting phrase. And I thought of that as the title
beautiful
of a short
phrase.
Story.
Yeah.
A pelican in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Beautiful
so,
phrase. Yeah. You, of course, grew up in a very big family, surrounded by lots of family.
Yeah,
do you think that shaped you a lot, Joe?
Well, it certainly shaped me because, like, by the time I was 17, like, I had spent time behind the bar, tapping barrels of Guinness, preparing coffins for bodies, buying fruit for my mother, like every possible thing. I was killing sheep for another. I was sort of that age in the generation, like, where this was expected of you. And I learned from my grandfather very early, like, you know, people who break sweat are not great use to the world. You know, you're better off, like, to delegate, to organise, to manage, etc. But all my uncles knew that, so they would get it to me, and my mother would, you know, whatever. Like, I've said to people many times, like, if you can stick your nose into a box of oranges and know that there's a rotten orange at the bottom of the back, or if you can buy wool with stones mixed in with it for farmers trying to bring up the weight and deal with those kind of things, and, you know, prepare a coffin for a body, etc. Like, you do learn another side of the world.
And do you delegate, or do you break sweat?
I never break sweat, no. I think I haven't worked since I left England, actually. that's the truth of it. You know,
that shows a real difference between Joe and myself, because I think he had an experience as a child that was invaluable. I was probably overprotected. When I went to boarding school, I couldn't tie my shoelaces properly because it had always been done for me. And I went when I was about seven, and I wasn't allowed breakfast because I couldn't tie my shoelaces properly. I made an attempt, but it wasn't terribly good.
How old are you at this stage?
Seven.
Okay.
And that's outrageous. You know?
Well, I don't know. But you see, if I'd been making...
7-year-olds who'd find laces quite difficult.
But if I'd been making coffins and murdering sheep, and I never came across that. I never had to kill anything.
It came back to me when the first time I arrived in Dingle with Joan to meet my grandfather, whom I loved
that's
dearly.
Your wife, shape.
Yeah, Joan, yeah. And he met her and he says, "Tell me now, Geglin, are you in land? Are you in business or have you land?" And that continued like that. But of course, he'd ham it up like completely, you know.
You see, while Joe was slaughtering the sheep, and he probably slaughtered the fatter calf to welcome Joan home, and she thought it was a metaphor, but he was actually out the back with a knife, you know, stuck in the jugular. Yeah. But I was going into a pet shop with my mother, and I remember I bought the loneliest and most miserable and most bedraggled budgerigar in the shop, because I felt I'm the only one that's going to be able to give you life.
Oh.
And then I left it hanging in the French window and it froze to death.
Oh,
but I always wanted to do the best. You know, and I my heart went out to the maimed and the injured.
You should have left the budgerigar in the shop.
The shop, of course.
Oh, I know, safer.
Yes, it would. And it was the same with my poor Transylvanian Aunt Gabriella, whom I pushed a rather large policeman in through the window to rescue her when she went a bit potty. And I did everything I could for her, but she ended up dying in distress. She was very confused. And I just sometimes think if I'd left her there in her little house, she might have just fizzled out and would have been so much better.
Who is this that died in distress?
This is my Uncle Maxwell's wife from Transylvania, who was quite an interesting woman. Because what curious thing was, I knew all my mother's people well, and I feel 100% Irish, although I'm genetically half English. Because my mother and my mother's family looked down on my father's family simultaneously. Each of them looked down on each other at the same time, but mathematically impossible, but socially a real possibility.
And regular.
But I was never given any information about my father's family at all.
Why do you think that was?
My mother didn't like them.
Okay.
And she disdained them. What I found was I found these wonderfully exotic blossoms in my father's family, like this awful Aunt Pauline, who came when I was about eight, and in a chauffeur-driven car, and told my mother that she had killed my father by overworking him, and left my mother in a puddle of tears, and never sent the stamps that she promised me either, which was even worse.
So but you've never forgiven
she
her.
She was a flying ace.
But isn't it interesting that you have been surrounded by those strong women in his family background as well? You know, that was something that I would always have felt in common. That my father was very kind of thoughtful man and very direct and very wise in dealing with good advice. You know, but it was my grandmother who would say things like, "Don't ever know your place." You know,
good for her.
That's how people are kept in control. You know, politics would have been discussed every single day and every single night in my grandparents and in my parents' house.
And forbidden in mine.
Isn't that extraordinary?
You did not speak about religion, politics or sex.
We're going to take the first piece of music, which I know is a choice you like, Joe, which is the Old Comrades.
Old Comrades is the Rand tune in Dingle, and it comes from them. If you listen to it, what you'll hear is you think you're in the 12th of July in the north. It's an old military, come from the old military occupations of Dingle, but it has been taken over by the Dingle Fife and Drum Band, which goes out every New Year's Eve, every Patrick's morning at 6 o'clock, and always at the big day in Dingle, the Rand's Day, on the 26th of December. If you turn the volume up on this, listen to it and close your eyes, you'll feel Dingle.
And it's a perfect choice for Joe, because anybody who knows him would feel that he is a comrade. So I'm well done. I didn't know you were going to choose that, but it's perfect.
Interesting about that tune and the people who are playing it in the recording, that was recorded in Flaherty's pub in Dingle. That's Fergus Flaherty playing my other first cousin, John Benny Moriarty. And the editor of the Kerryman, I think, is playing there as well, Tom Lynch. Like, as we speak, they are preparing the straw suits for the Rand. They will have started that now after the 1st of November.
Yeah, no,
so
it's wonderful.
All part of it.
When did you two first meet each other, David? Can you remember?
25 years ago, when we were elected to the Senate. We were both kind of new boys in there, but we were similar in temperament, as you said in the introduction, I think, because we were both very independent-minded. And we both, I think, felt that we should have some loose association of senators. And Joe is a natural leader, and he brought us together. Now,
this is when I've left.
This was
never mentioned for 25 years.
Oh, no. And we put together, we spoke to the others, we put together a group. And I think that was probably the first independent group.
Miriam, I was faced with this avalanche of a group with David Norris, Professor John A. Murphy, Brendan Ryan, Mary Robinson,
and Shane Ross.
And I said, like, how am I going to survive here? You know, so I said, look, I think we should form a group. And I think it was two of them, I'm not sure, I think it was Mary Robinson and John A. proposed in a second that I'd become the representative.
No, Mary Robinson wasn't. What was Mary Robinson?
Yeah, she was. And so I had that job for 25 years. And I decided the only way that I could make it successful is to tell them nothing.
That's represent a very their best cute interest. Thing to do. Right?
Well, you could actually get it out of them if you really wanted to. And I'd say this, our policy was, and we both felt this strongly, that we were a group. But what held the group together was that we were all independent of each other.
Yes.
And it meant we triggered speaking rights and positions on committee. And for example, as a result of that, I was instrumental in the moves that led to the creation of the Foreign Affairs Committee.
Right.
And I've been on it ever since without a single break. And that's thanks to the management of the people involved and the fact that they respected the fact that if somebody had an expertise in a particular area or an interest in a particular area, then they would cover that for the group. But the others could distance themselves from your views if they didn't agree with them.
But I could do everything except be referred to as leader. So the leaders of the other parties in the Senate, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, would regularly stand up and refer to me as the leader
first
of the independent
among
group.
Equals.
And David would always be sitting there, jump up and say, there is no leader of the independent group. Followed by Shane Ross. And John A would say, independent means being independent of all others.
You know, you shared an office, did you, for a while?
We did indeed. And we shared secretaries for quite a long time.
Did you ever fight?
No, but we didn't.
Not really.
The thing I remember about that period of time, I would have been loosely involved in kind of gay rights in supporting them, not taking any kind of leading thing, but I would have been quite supportive of that before I was elected, etc. And I do recall saying to David one time, the only time I can ever remember him, like he'd be completely silent
non-plus.
For 30 seconds and nonplussed, was because I didn't assume that everybody involved in gay rights was gay. So I said, David, look, it's not a big issue for me one way or the other, but tell me, are you actually gay yourself? he just looked at me. He said, you must be the last man in Ireland, not at all. I said, no, I just wouldn't have paid a lot of attention to the fact.
Yeah. See, I felt an identification with that because I don't have any gaydar either. I've never been able to tell whether people were or not.
Really?
No, never.
Yeah.
And I'm not bothered.
Yeah.
You know, unless there was somebody I thought was really wonderful and I wanted to see if I could start a relationship or something. I mean, those moments are very, very rare in my life.
But I do.
So I don't care what people are.
I do think over that period, Miriam, and kind of a sad note, really. I know David knows my views on this, though we haven't discussed it for many years. Like, I came to a very solid conclusion looking at the hate mail that came in month after month, not in huge volumes, but regular, to David about being a gay man in Ireland. And I would take the view to anybody. There's no need to be making a kind of a statement of your sexuality.
But I had a wall, and I used to pin them all up on the wall. Yeah. And to be quite honest with you, I found them immensely reassuring. And a lot of them made me laugh.
They were horrific, though.
They were, but I mean, these were people who were telling me I was unbalanced. And I would not be able to say on a Sunday morning the kind of alterations and improvements they were suggesting for my physique and whatever else.
But you shouldn't have to receive mail like that, actually.
But I didn't
mind. Maybe you become immune to it.
That's the issue.
Yes, but it didn't affect, because I just felt that these people are unbalanced.
Mm. No, but you became desensitized to it, David, and it was really bad. You know, I'm not saying, like, yeah. It was your way of dealing with it, and I'm not saying, I would probably have done exactly the same.
You have to survive.
But for me, like, it just really sickened me to think that there were this number of people who would take the trouble, as David said, to sit down and pen a letter, not of vitriol, but of nastiness, horrible stuff. Mm.
Well, I don't mind, but what is much more wounding is people who deliberately misinterpret your motives. And I have always believed in the truth. And I have in my mind a picture of Mary Curie Skłodowska. And she was the woman who reduced in a laboratory tons of pitch blend down to that one little tiny luminous core of radium, which is a kind of elemental truth. But in the photograph, she's in America, she's going to give a lecture, and her hands are burnt and her face is lined and burnt, and she died from radiation. And I think that's like truth. If you tell the truth, if you always, at no matter what cost, try to pursue the truth, even if you're wrong and somebody will tell you and you can say I'm wrong, but if you do that, it's like handling radium. But it, like radium, radium can heal cancer. And the truth, and only by facing the truth can we advance. But then when people take that and they misinterpret it, that I find desperately wounding. People using filthy language at me or threatening to do various things to me, I honestly still find that funny.
But I was struck by a photograph in your book of two Iranian men being hanged not that many years ago for being gay. I mean, it actually really frightened me when I saw that image.
Four or five years ago, and I was horrified. And it was a married couple down in Cork who sent me that photograph and told me, but I didn't know about it. There is a video where you can see the actual hanging. I couldn't bear to watch it. And these were two young men,
handsome, beautiful young men.
They were 18, 19. They should have had all the lives ahead of them. And they were betrayed by somebody to the religious police. Those awful whited sepulchres. They were taken into the police station, beaten.
Just for being gay. They were humiliated.
And then they were taken, and from the back of a lorry on a crane, they were hanged. And what really pierces my heart is they didn't have the feeling of being martyrs. There was no heroism. They felt lower than the dirt under their feet. And that's a shocking thing, to go to eternity feeling like that. Yeah. And that's why I'm still angry. It's this, like Swift, savage indignation against that. And so I will continue to speak out.
Joe?
But David, like, one of the things about that time, just going back to it again in our heads, was at that time, this might seem strange, but like 25 years ago.
In the Senate.
In Irish life, people equated being gay with child abuse. Like, you know, it is only now, 17 reports later, when people recognise that child abuse and childhood has nothing whatever to do with being gay or whatever. I mean, I remember, like, people would say, like, well, you know, would you leave David near your children? I mean, I saw David with our kids when they were young, and I remember when Canova one day, around this time of the year, around Halloween.
It was lovely. And I reviewed you because you cooked Rogan
Josh.
It was
wonderful.
I gave you five stars.
Like, Vincent Brown made him a food critic. Now, it took me a while to get over that.
Was this in the Tribune?
No. The Tribune, yes. Yep. In the Tribune. So at one stage, I said that he was going to all those expensive places and that you could kind of cook something at a better price. I said, I'll cook for 30, I think it was 30 quid or something, a meal for four people in my own house. Joe, my wife, is a really good Indian cook. But on this occasion, I did all the cooking. I did Rogan Josh. I remember I did a fruit curry. And I remember doing a few other bits and pieces. Very pleased with it. So we all sat back to read the review next Sunday. Except the review had all the cooking done by Joan.
I don't believe that.
That is absolutely true.
Well, in that case, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa.
Did you know that David was going to stand for the presidency?
Yes.
Did he seek your advice or did you offer any?
Well, I said it to Joe.
Could
I put it this way?
I like that silence. Can I get an answer?
In a way, Coy, he was not enthusiastic. I think he felt that I could come unstuck.
Okay, let me ask
I rather him. Wish that I had probed him a bit further on that.
Okay, that's interesting because you're very positive about David. Why were you worried about him?
I suppose if I just go into the campaign itself, and at the time when David withdrew from the campaign.
Well, can we go back before that?
Yeah, but before that, yeah. I mean, I said to him, David, if you're going to go on a campaign, you need 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And I said, and I'm not going to be involved because I felt I couldn't get involved at that level. And to fairness, David came back and he had done all 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, okay. Whatever, setting up campaign team and various people who were, I have to say, impressive people in the few times that I was speaking with them. But what the campaign team, I'm sure it's okay to say this, David, like, is that they did respect my position, but they did ask, like, they did say, well, you know, suppose we need to touch base with you or get a view on something. And I said, I have no problem with that anytime. So that was certainly done right the way through.
Yes.
But I felt after David withdrew, I did. I remember I was actually in France at the time, and David rang me at the time, and he discussed it. And I certainly was uncomfortable with the idea of him returning to it.
I think the mistake was getting out. I should not have got out. I should have stuck it out. Now,
but should you have ever gone in? Should you have ever gone in?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I have no regrets. No one's in a regret. But I think it was a mistake to pull out. But I'm glad I went back in. But it was very difficult not to pull out because a section of my team had started to unravel. And the thing that hurt me most was they did not believe me that, for example, I had overlooked the letters. We went back 10 years and they said, we don't want to go into all that old stuff again. But the fact that they thought I had deliberately withheld stuff, I would never do that. And I felt really hurt that they thought that. And then every single political commentator said he's got to get out. And so it was overwhelming.
But I think, David, like, you're still sort of hurt about it.
Yes.
Understood. And there's still, like, a bitterness which is not really part to you. And I kind of feel that there's a plus side. Like, there were tens of thousands of people who voted for him, you know, and I think that
110,000.
Yeah, well, that is.
And
the,
I also think.
Yeah, that's the important part.
There was no tally done, really. But we had unofficial tally people around the place. And we worked out that at least 60% of my first preference went to Michael D. And I was very pleased with that. And at least the same came back from him to me, or would have. But what happened really was that there was a different lie. And people actually told the most flagrant lies about me. I mean, there were certain areas that were grey, but there were simple, downright lies. And it became such a crescendo that they didn't even care what they said. Anything was possible to be said. And it was like fighting every single snowflake in a blizzard. And people became unsure. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people said to me, well, we gave you the number two. We gave Michael D the number. So, and I think that was the effect. That was what really... But the lovely thing was, first of all, I made sure there was an election because I'm morally certain that the parties were doing their damnedest. In fact, I know that, to install an unelected person. So I managed to force an election. I helped to set the parameters, the three pillars, the mental health and awareness, suicide and all this kind of stuff, enterprise and culture, and look for the reform of the presidency. And at the end of it, I think it opened the door for Michael D. Higgins, who, if the forces that were there that were against me wanted to stop a liberal, my goodness, they didn't, because we got a great liberal in Michael D.
Do you know what I often wonder? I mean, I suppose you were a senator for quite a number of years. Yes. Although you're an academic, you've been in, you know, the body politic. Do you ever look back, and I hear what you're saying, and I don't want to go all over Ezra and the letters because I think people are weary listening to all the detail. But I suppose, was there a part of you that thought maybe there was a naivety? Like, if you didn't think those letters were going to be maybe relevant or brought up, was that naive? Because presidential campaigns are very bloody and very brutal.
But there's never been one as filthy as this, and never a concentration on one candidate in the way everything was said about me. And there was an extraordinary degree of homophobia in it, although it was denied. You know, the people said, some of my best friends are, but...
Did you feel sorry for David when all this was going on? I mean,
I absolutely did. Yeah, no, absolutely did. I mean, I mean, once that slide started, I knew what he was going on. In fairness, like, he rang a few times, we discussed it and whatever. But like, at that stage, as he says himself, like, at that stage, like, the stone had was started.
Did you tell him not to go back in at any stage? Did you ever say to him, "Do not re-enter"?
Well, I said, in my view, that it would be better for him not to go back in. But we actually never discussed the point that he made about should he never have left maybe in the first place. That's an interesting point. But what was happening was that a lot of well-meaning people were putting him under pressure to go back in. I mean, that was an actual fact. It wasn't his imagination. It wasn't David's imagination. There was a lot of support there. But in that, like, it just didn't materialise in the quantity or that was necessary.
But I was glad I went back. And I hope that I went back with courage and grace and dignity. And I didn't lose that in coping with some really vile things and situations, including being physically attacked on the street. And I do remember that very clearly. And I remember the unspeakable things that people who would have thought of themselves as civilised permitted themselves to say about me.
And you should never have had to suffer any of that. But do you, David Norris, blame yourself for anything?
Oh, yes, I do. I do. One thing in particular, I should really have taken command of the campaign. And I should have made sure that I was involved in all the major decisions. And that was my fault. But on the other hand, you see, I was released and I was out around the countryside. And I loved that. I visited every single county in this country
and I think
twice.
That was the way to do it. I mean, I don't agree that was a mistake. I mean, I think the value of what you did was there was a campaign team who were good at what they did. And I think that, okay, I know it came to a terrible end, but I'm just saying while it was working, it worked really well, I thought, you know. And
just before we bring in David Sweetsmead, why a few moments back, David said that originally you didn't want him to go in long before Ezra letters, anything came out. Why was your instinct for him not to?
I just had this sense that something would come up. I remember saying this to David. And David said to me after it's all over, I don't know. It's just a sixth sense.
Because I gave so many hostages to fortune. Tom Hyland, who's a great friend of mine from the East Timor campaign, he said they will absolutely crucify him. And several people said that to me. And well, they did. But what that I don't mind, I can take that. And after crucifixion, there is resurrection. But the thing I will never, never, never forgive, and the thing that I find disgusting and contemptible, is the people close to me were also crucified. And they had nothing to do with my campaign. And the people who did that should be bitterly ashamed. And I despise them.
Yeah.
You're not a bitter person, but if you go through something like that, and even if partly it's your own doing, has it changed you? Has it made you?
Yes, it has, because I'm the kind of person, if you smile at me, I will tell you my whole unexplicated life story. And that's still my instinct. But I have the first word out and something stops. And I think, what will they make of this?
Yeah.
If I make a slip, an honest slip of the tongue, they'll twist it.
Yeah, but I think, David, I would hope that now having written the book, and putting it behind you and recognising the level of support you got, that you can now look, it's behind you and just moved on, you give it a good run.
Nothing much worse can happen, frankly.
Yeah, exactly.
No, and it's taken all the gags away. I mean, I'll say whatever I like. And at the end of the book, I do say this because I had just watched, I wrote it all, I rewrote it 15 times from beginning to end. Because I wanted it, I started off doing it for the money because I thought it helped to pay off the expenses because it really took all my life savings. But the minute I started on it, I started seeing it, if it's not an impertinent or self-aggrandizing thing to say, as a little work of art. And I wanted to make it as perfect as possible. Jer Siggins, who was a tremendous help and who typed it all out, because I can't type or do computers, his wife told me that she used to hear gales of laughter coming out from under the door as he was typing this stuff up. And towards the end, I'd been to see a film called The Best Exotic Magenta Hotel, or Marigold or something. And they were all old fogies and they went off to this place they thought was going to be great instead of drooling in front of the TVs or being tolerated by their ghastly relatives. And it doesn't match up to their ideas and they complain. And the wonderful young Indian manager says, but everything will come all right in the end. And if it is not all right now, that just means we have not yet got to the end. And I think, what a wonderful philosophy of life.
Yeah.
We go on. And life gets better. And there are so many wonderful, wonderful people. There are some nasty, vicious, awful people. But they're a tiny minority that do disproportionate
Most
damage.
People are lovely.
Yeah. Most people are wonderful. Yeah.
Which brings us to your piece of music, David, which is the Edith Piaf.
Yes, and it's not Jeanette Gretzriana. It's J'en ai le droit d'aimer. I have the right to love. Ni les lois, neither the laws or anything else will
Say
stop
in French,
me because I will love. J'en ai le droit d'aimer. Quelle que soit la couronne, les épines.
croire. Jamais rien ni personne empêchera d'aimer.
Beautiful Edith Piaf.
Well, I don't think it will. I mean, I think what's actually happened is that if you take the trouble to read the Constitution, the model of the Seanad in the Constitution is perfect. It's a bridge between politics and the people. It has every representative group in it, except the people voted for the referendum in 1937 before they saw the legislation that was going to set up the Seanad. And the legislation made it a creature of the political parties, which has never contemplated. Now that I'm no longer a senator, I can make the case for the Seanad with no vested interest. Nobody can say he's looking after himself. Like he's looking. I can make the case. And I had a brief word with the Taoiseach recently. And I said, look, Enda, you're in a corner in this. Like, we are working on a piece of legislation. He now has the opportunity to put together and to give the Irish people the Seanad that they voted for in 1937 and never got.
The real weakness of it was that the only group that had the ordinary membership given the vote were the university senators. And if they revised the nominating bodies, I'll just take one thing, simple, easy thing to do, and made sure that they reflected all of Irish life. Trade unions, fishermen, mothers who stay at home, whatever it is, all these groups, and then allowed the ordinary membership of those to choose which panel to be on and to vote. Then you'd include all the people, you'd bring in the expertise that was supposed to be brought in.
I suppose if you never did anything else in your career, David Norris, the fact that you changed the law on homosexuality in this country, that alone would stand to you
and
as your single greatest achievement.
And the civil partnership. I think
I produced the first civil partnership bill. Well, I don't think about it very much. I remember somebody said to me a while ago, you know, do you feel people aren't grateful? And I said, well, I don't want them to be because, you know, I didn't want to remove
one. Do you regard it as your greatest achievement in your career?
I'll tell you what really warmed my heart when I felt it was all worth it. I was down in the west of Ireland, in a rural part, and this very nice woman came, very traditional Catholic, and gave me a cup of tea and told me, go into the supermarket, tell the fellow I sent you. And there were two very nice young men there. And they said, could they have a photograph? And when they'd gone, there was an elderly lady pushing her trolley, and she said, aren't they lovely? And, you know, they're a couple, and we're very proud of them. And I thought, in rural Ireland, how absolutely wonderful. And even though, as I said to somebody when about civil partnership, they said, was I getting civil partnered myself? And I said, well, I spent so much time pushing the boat out that I forgot to jump on. I don't mind. It was all worth it to see those happy young people and organisations like Belong To, a generation of young people who are unscarred.
Does it ever make you feel sad, though, David, that you almost missed that time? It's almost very late for you in your life. Do you ever look back and think, oh, I'd love to be 18 again with that freedom that people like you have achieved for young gay people?
I've never believed in looking back, except with pleasure. And to see the patterns that can give meaning to your life. But you go on. And I think it's wonderful to get older because you develop what I call stabiliser
fins. But would you like to be married yourself?
Of course I would.
Are you lonely?
I didn't realize I was until this campaign, and that revealed that to me, and that was very sad.
But you could still meet somebody.
Yes, and I have lots of really loving and good friends around me, but there is a central core of loneliness. As you said at the beginning, Marion, I love the idea of a family.
Yeah,
and that's what kept me with people.
And many times, like over the years, David would have said to me or to few of us or whatever that he looked forward to retirement with a partner.
Yeah. Are you religious, Joe?
Well, I think when you ask me that question, if you ask me something more specific, I can answer it more easily.
Would you believe in a God?
I would be an agnostic. I have seen no proof either way to swing.
Oh, you're playing cute there.
Yeah, well, no, but it is. Yeah. Like, I mean, I used to say to Ronan Mullen and to Ivana Bacik, as far as I'm concerned, one an atheist, the other a theist. To say, I don't know the difference. Like, we go to the extremes of logic, and then you see a God over there and you see nothing over there. I said, I just go to the extremes of logic, and I honestly don't know what's there next.
Do you think there's a heaven?
Do you know, I'm so arrogant that I think that it would be a great loss to whatever sphere we live on, were I just to die in the ground. But I expect just simply to be put in the ground.
Well, I agree with Joe. I think it would be a great loss if there wasn't a place for him somewhere in the eternal mysteries.
What do you think, David? Do you believe in anything?
I do, yes. Mm-hmm. And I find my faith confirmed all the time. And it's a personal faith, and it is a Christian faith. And it is the figure of Jesus Christ who speaks to me. across the centuries. And I agree with Joe in this sense, that I think the most honest and the most important theological principle is the principle of positive doubt. I don't believe anybody who says they have no doubts whatever, and they're the ones who do danger because they try to inflict their narrow view on other people. So it's all about power.
Do you think you'll meet in heaven, the pair of you?
Well, I think every day is heaven, you know. I mean, yeah. I just think every day that you get up and
I
enjoy
it. Because I don't know, but I think we're just kind of reabsorbed into the great consciousness. But I also feel that there will be the loving arms of God placed around you at the moment of death.
I think that's the hope.
But I believe it.
Yeah. But I think it's also important that in a republic, we should absolutely insist that people have the right to practice their religion. I would never join the club of people like who feel that being liberal is being
anti-religious. Well, that's a frightful heresy. And I remember being in court when a young barrister tried to defend the Hare Krishna on the constitutional grounds that they were practicing their religion. And the judge, who appeared to have been asleep, snapped up and said, "Practice the religion? What kind of a defence do you think is that in my court, young man? What do you think would happen in this country if everyone went round doing that?" It's a very interesting question.
And on that note, we are going to leave it.
Thanks, for
Joe too. David Norris, I hope you stay friends forever. My thanks on sound today to Noel Roberts, to my producer Arlene Heron, and of course Joe's book, Looking Under Stones, and David's book, A Kick Against the Pricks, are both available in the bookshops now. Thank you all very much for listening. We're going out listening to a piece of music you both separately chose, and it is
The Ballad of Joe Hill. That
by Luke Kelly.
Well, I would have preferred
Paul Robeson.
Paul Robeson.
Yeah, but I explained to him this is an Irish trade unionist song, yeah. Really.
And it's not. And it, in either of them, it's a spirit of triumph that the spirit goes on.
Come on, Luke.
How am I going to solve this? I'm going to let my producer decide. Thank you both very much. And thank you all very much for listening. We're going out listening to somebody singing Joe Hill.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.